The Seven Conditions for Achieving Flow. According to researcher Owen Schaefer of DePaul University, the requirements for achieving flow are 1. Knowing what to do. 2. Knowing how to do it. 3. Knowing how well you are doing. 4. Knowing where to go, where navigation is involved. 5. Perceiving significant challenges. 6. Perceiving significant skills. 7. Being free from distractions. Strategy 1. Choose a difficult task, but not too difficult. Schaefer's model encourages us to take on tasks that we have a chance of completing, but that are slightly out of our comfort zone. Every task, sport, or job has a set of rules, and we need a set of skills to follow them. If the rules for completing a task or achieving a purpose are too basic relative to our skill set, we will likely get bored. Activities that are too easy lead to apathy. If, on the other hand, we assign ourselves a task that is too difficult, we won't have the skills to complete it and will almost certainly give up and feel frustrated to boot. The ideal is to find a middle path, something aligned with our abilities but just a bit of a stretch, so we experience it as a challenge. This is what Ernest Hemingway meant when he said, "Sometimes I write better than I can." We want to see challenges through to the end because we enjoy the feeling of pushing ourselves. Bertrand Russell expressed a similar idea when he said, "To be able to concentrate for a considerable amount of time is essential to difficult achievement." If you're a graphic designer, learn a new software program for your next project. If you're a programmer, use a new programming language. If you're a dancer, try to incorporate into your next routine a movement that has seemed impossible for years. Add a little something extra, something that takes you out of your comfort zone. Even doing something as simple as reading means following certain rules, having certain abilities and knowledge. If we set out to read a book on quantum mechanics for specialists in physics without being specialists in physics ourselves, we'll probably give up after a few minutes. On the other end of the spectrum, if we already know everything a book has to tell us, we'll get bored right away. However, if the book is appropriate to our knowledge and abilities and builds on what we already know, we'll immerse ourselves in our reading and time will flow. This pleasure and satisfaction are evidence that we are in tune with our ikigai. See PDF. Strategy 2. Have a clear, concrete objective. Video games, played in moderation, board games, and sports are great ways to achieve flow because the objective tends to be very clear. Beat your rival or your own record while following a set of explicitly defined rules. Unfortunately, the objective isn't quite as clear in most situations. According to a study by Boston Consulting Group, when asked about their bosses, the number one complaint of employees at multinational corporations is that they don't communicate the team's mission clearly, and that, as a result, the employees don't know what their objectives are. What often happens, especially in big companies, is that the executives get lost in the details of obsessive planning, creating strategies to hide the fact that they don't have a clear objective. It's like heading out to sea with a map but no destination. It is much more important to have a compass pointing to a concrete objective than to have a map. Joy Ito, director of the MIT Media Lab, encourages us to use the principle of compass over maps as a tool to navigate our world of uncertainty. In the book, Whiplash, How to Survive Our Faster Future, he and Jeff Howe write, "In an increasingly unpredictable world moving ever more quickly, a detailed map may lead you deep into the woods at an unnecessarily high cost. A good compass, though, will always take you where you need to go. It doesn't mean that you should start your journey without any idea where you're going. What it does mean is understanding that while the path to your goal may not be straight, you'll finish faster and more efficiently than you would have if you had trudged along a pre-planned route." In business, the creative professions and education alike, it's important to reflect on what we hope to achieve before starting to work, study, or make something. we should ask ourselves questions such as, what is my objective for today's session in the studio? How many words am I going to write today for the article coming out next month? What is my team's mission? How fast will I set the metronome tomorrow in order to play that sonata at an allegro tempo by the end of the week? Having a clear objective is important in achieving flow, but we also have to know how to leave it behind when we get down to business. Once the journey has begun, we should keep this objective in mind without obsessing over it. When Olympic athletes compete for a gold medal, they can't stop to think how pretty the medal is. They have to be present in the moment. They have to flow. If they lose focus for a second, thinking how proud they'll be to show the medal to their parents, they'll almost certainly commit an error at a critical moment and will not win the competition. One common example of this is writer's block. Imagine that a writer has to finish a novel in 3 months. The objective is clear. The problem is that the writer can't stop obsessing over it. Every day she wakes up thinking, I have to write that novel. And every day she sets about reading the newspaper and cleaning the house. Every evening she feels frustrated and promises she'll get to work the next day. Days, weeks, and months pass, and the writer still hasn't gotten anything down on the page, when all it would have taken was to sit down and get that first word out, then the second, to flow with the project, expressing her ikigai. As soon as you take these first small steps, your anxiety will disappear, and you will achieve a pleasant flow in the activity you're doing. Getting back to Albert Einstein, a happy man is too satisfied with the present to dwell on the future. See PDF. Strategy 3. Concentrate on a single task. This is perhaps one of the greatest obstacles we face today, with so much technology and so many distractions. We're listening to a video on YouTube while writing an email, when suddenly a chat prompt pops up and we answer it. Then our smartphone vibrates in our pocket. Just as soon as we respond to that message, we're back at our computer logging onto Facebook. Pretty soon, 30 minutes have passed and we've forgotten what the email we were writing was supposed to be about. This also happens sometimes when we put on a movie with dinner and don't realize how delicious the salmon was until we're taking the last bite. We often think that combining tasks will save us time, but scientific evidence shows that it has the opposite effect. Even those who claim to be good at multitasking are not very productive. In fact, they are some of the least productive people. Our brains can take in millions of bits of information, but can only actually process a few dozen per second. When we say we're multitasking, what we're really doing is switching back and forth between tasks very quickly. Unfortunately, we're not computers adept at parallel processing. We end up spending all our energy alternating between tasks instead of focusing on doing one of them well. Concentrating on one thing at a time may be the single most important factor in achieving flow. According to Jisenk Mihayu, in order to focus on a task, we need 1. To be in a distraction-free environment. 2. To have control over what we're doing at every moment. Technology is great if we're in control of it. It's not so great if it takes control of us. For example, if you have to write a research paper, you might sit down at your computer and use Google to look up the information you need. However, if you're not very disciplined, you might end up surfing the web instead of writing that paper. In that case, Google and the internet will have taken over, pulling you out of your state of flow. It has been scientifically shown that if we continually ask our brains to switch back and forth between tasks, we waste time, make more mistakes, and remember less of what we've done. Several studies conducted at Stanford University by Clifford Ivar Nass describe our generation as suffering from an epidemic of multitasking. One such study analyzed the behavior of hundreds of students, dividing them into groups based on the number of things they tended to do at once. The students who were the most addicted to multitasking typically alternated among more than four tasks. For example, taking notes while reading a textbook, listening to a podcast, answering messages on their smartphone, and sometimes checking their Twitter timeline. Each group of students was shown a screen with several red and several blue arrows. The objective of the exercise was to count the red arrows. At first, all the students answered correctly right away without much trouble. As the number of blue arrows increased, the number of red arrows stayed the same, only their position changed. However, the students accustomed to multitasking had serious trouble counting the red arrows in the time allotted, or as quickly as the students who did not habitually multitask for one very simple reason. They got distracted by the blue arrows. Their brains were trained to pay attention to every stimulus, regardless of its importance, while the brains of the other students were trained to focus on a single task, in this case, counting the red arrows and ignoring the blue ones. Other studies indicate that working on several things at once lowers our productivity by at least 60% and our IQ by more than 10 points. One study funded by the Swedish Council for Working Life and Social Research found that a sample group of more than 4,000 young adults between the ages of 20 and 24 who were addicted to their smartphones got less sleep, felt less connected to their community at school, and were more likely to show signs of depression. See PDF. What can we do to avoid falling victim to this flow-impeding epidemic? How can we train our brains to focus on a single task? Here are a few ideas for creating a space and time free of distractions to increase our chances of reaching a state of flow and thereby getting in touch with our ikigai. Don't look at any kind of screen for the first hour you're awake and the last hour before you go to sleep. Turn off your phone before you achieve flow. There is nothing more important than the task you have chosen to do during this time. If this seems too extreme, enable the Do Not Disturb function, so only the people closest to you can contact you in case of emergency. Designate one day of the week, perhaps a Saturday or a Sunday, a day of technological fasting, making exceptions only for e-readers without Wi-Fi or MP3 players. Go to a cafe that doesn't have Wi-Fi. Read and respond to email only once or twice per day. Define those times clearly and stick to them. Try the Pomodoro technique. Get yourself a kitchen timer. Some are made to look like a pomodoro or tomato. And commit to working on a single task as long as it's running. The Pomodoro technique recommends 25 minutes of work and 5 minutes of rest for each cycle. But you can also do 50 minutes of work and 10 minutes of rest. Find the pace that's best for you. The most important thing is to be disciplined in completing each cycle. Start your work session with a ritual you enjoy and end it with a reward. Train your mind to return to the present when you find yourself getting distracted. Practice mindfulness or another form of meditation. Go for a walk or a swim. Whatever will help you get centered again. Work in a space where you will not be distracted. If you can't do this at home, go to a library, a cafe, or if your task involves playing a saxophone, a music studio. If you find that your surroundings continue to distract you, keep looking until you find the right place. Divide each activity into groups of related tasks and assign each group its own place and time. For example, if you're writing a magazine article, you could do research and take notes at home in the morning, write in the library in the afternoon, and edit on the couch at night. Bundle routine tasks, such as sending out invoices, making phone calls, and so on, and do them all at once. See PDF. Flow in Japan. Takumis, engineers, geniuses, and otakus. What do takumis, artisans, engineers, inventors, and otakus, fans of anime and manga, have in common? They all understand the importance of flowing with their ikigai at all times. One widespread stereotype about people in Japan is that they're exceptionally dedicated and hardworking, even though some Japanese people say they look like they're working harder than they really are. There is no doubt, though, about their ability to be completely absorbed in a task, or about their perseverance when there is a problem to be solved. One of the first words one learns when starting Japanese lessons is "ganbaru," which means to persevere or to stay firm by doing one's best. Japanese people often apply themselves to even the most basic tasks with an intensity that borders on obsession. We see this in all kinds of contexts, from the retirees taking meticulous care of their rice fields in the mountains of Nagano, to the college students working the weekend shift in convenience stores known as konbinis. If you go to Japan, you'll experience this attention to detail firsthand in almost every transaction. Walk into one of the stores that sell handcrafted objects in Naha, Kanazawa, or Kyoto, and you'll also discover that Japan is a treasure trove of traditional craftwork. The people of Japan have a unique talent for creating new technologies while preserving artisanal traditions and techniques. The art of the takumi. Toyota employs artisans who are able to make a certain type of screw by hand. These takumi, or experts in a particular manual skill, are extremely important to Toyota, and they are hard to replace. Some of them are the only people who know how to perform their exact skill, and it doesn't seem as though a new generation is going to take up the mantle. Turntable needles are another example. They're produced almost exclusively in Japan, where you can find the last remaining people who know how to use the machinery required to make these precision needles and who are trying to pass on their knowledge to their descendants. We met a takumi on a visit to Kumano, a small town near Hiroshima. We were there for a day, working on a photo essay for one of the most famous brands of makeup brushes in the West. The billboard welcoming visitors to Kumano shows a mascot holding a large brush. In addition to the brush factories, the town is full of little houses and vegetable gardens. Heading farther in, you can see several Shinto shrines at the base of the mountains that surround the town. We spent hours taking photos in factories full of people in orderly rows, each doing a single task, such as painting the handles of the brushes or loading boxes of them onto trucks, before we realized we still hadn't seen anyone actually putting bristles into the brush heads. After we asked about this and got the runaround several times, the president of one company agreed to show us how it was done. He led us out of the building and asked us to get into his car. After a 5-minute drive, we parked next to another smaller structure and climbed the stairs. He opened a door, and we walked into a small room filled with windows that let in lovely natural light. In the middle of the room was a woman wearing a mask. You could see only her eyes. She was so focused on choosing individual bristles for the brushes, gracefully moving her hands and fingers, using scissors and combs to sort the bristles, that she hadn't even noticed our presence. Her movements were so quick, it was hard to tell what she was doing. The president of the company interrupted her to let her know that we'd been taking photos as she worked. We couldn't see her mouth, but the glint in her eye and the cheerful inflection in her speech let us know she was smiling. She looked happy and proud talking about her work and responsibilities. We had to use extremely fast shutter speeds to capture her movements. Her hands danced and flowed in concert with her tools and the bristles she was sorting. The president told us that this takumi was one of the most important people in the company, even though she was hidden away in a separate building. Every bristle of every brush the company made passed through her hands. Steve Jobs in Japan. Apple co-founder Steve Jobs was a big fan of Japan. Not only did he visit the Sony factories in the 1980s and adopt many of their methods when he founded Apple, he was also captivated by the simplicity and the quality of Japanese porcelain in Kyoto. It was not, however, an artisan from Kyoto who won Steve Jobs' devotion, but rather a takumi from Toyama named Yukio Shakunaga, who used a technique called Echu Setoyaki, known by only a few. On a visit to Kyoto, Jobs heard of an exhibition of Shakunaga's work. He immediately understood that there was something special about Shakunaga's porcelain. As a matter of fact, he bought several cups, vases and plates and went back to the show 3 times that week. Jobs returned to Kyoto several times over the course of his life in search of inspiration and ended up meeting Shakunaga in person. It is said that Jobs had many questions for him, almost all of them about the fabrication process and the type of porcelain he used. Shakunaga explained that he used white porcelain he extracted himself from mountains in the Toyama Prefecture, making him the only artist of his ilk familiar with the fabrication process of porcelain objects from their origins in the mountains to their final form. An authentic takumi. Jobs was so impressed that he considered going to Toyama to see the mountain where Shakunaga got his porcelain, but thought better of it when he heard that it was more than 4 hours by train from Kyoto. In an interview after Jobs' death, Shakunaga said he was very proud that his work had been appreciated by the man who created the iPhone. He added that Jobs' last purchase from him had been a set of 12 teacups. Jobs had asked for something special, a new style. To satisfy this request, Shakunaga made 150 teacups in the process of testing out new ideas. Of these, he chose the 12 best and sent them to the Jobs family. Ever since his first trip to Japan, Jobs was fascinated and inspired by the country's artisans, engineers, especially at Sony, philosophy, especially Zen, and cuisine, especially sushi. Sophisticated simplicity. What do Japanese artisans, engineers, Zen philosophy, and cuisine have in common? Simplicity and attention to detail. It is not a lazy simplicity, but a sophisticated one that searches out new frontiers, always taking the object, the body and the mind, or the cuisine to the next level, according to one's ikigai. As Csikszentmihalyi would say, the key is always having a meaningful challenge to overcome in order to maintain flow. The documentary, Jiro Dreams of Sushi, gives us another example of a takumi, this time in the kitchen. Its protagonist has been making sushi every day for more than 80 years and owns a small sushi restaurant near the Ginza subway station in Tokyo. He and his son go every day to the famous Tsukiji fish market and choose the best fish to bring back to the restaurant. In the documentary, we see one of Jiro's apprentices learning to make tamago, a thin, slightly sweet omelette. No matter how hard he tries, he can't get Jiro's approval. He keeps practicing for years until he finally does. Why does the apprentice refuse to give up? Doesn't he get bored cooking eggs every day? No, because making sushi is his ikigai too. Both Jiro and his son are culinary artists. They don't get bored when they cook. They achieve a state of flow. They enjoy themselves completely when they are in the kitchen. That is their happiness, their ikigai. They've learned to take pleasure in their work, to lose their sense of time. Beyond the close relationship between father and son, which helps them keep the challenge going each day, they also work in a quiet, peaceful environment that allows them to concentrate. Even after receiving a 3-star rating from Michelin, they never considered opening other locations or expanding the business. They serve just 10 patrons at a time at the bar of their small restaurant. Jiro's family isn't looking to make money. Instead, they value good working conditions and creating an environment in which they can flow while making the best sushi in the world. Jiro, like Yukio Shakunaga, begins his work at the source. He goes to the fish market to find the best tuna. Shakunaga goes to the mountain to find the best porcelain. When they get down to work, both become one with the object they are creating. This unity with the object that they reach in a state of flow takes on special meaning in Japan, where, according to Shintoism, forest, trees, and objects have a kami, spirit or god, within them. When someone, whether an artist, an engineer, or a chef, sets out to create something, his or her responsibility is to use nature to give it life, while respecting that nature at every moment. During this process, the artisan becomes one with the object and flows with it. An iron worker would say that metal has a life of its own, just as someone making ceramics would say that clay does. The Japanese are skilled at bringing nature and technology together, not man versus nature, but rather a union of the two. The purity of Ghibli. There are those who say that the Shinto value of being connected with nature is vanishing. One of the harshest critics of this loss is another artist with a clearly defined ikigai, Hayao Miyazaki, the director of the animated films produced by Studio Ghibli. In nearly all his films, we see humans, technology, fantasy and nature in a state of conflict, and, in the end, coming together. One of the most poignant metaphors in his film, Spirited Away, is an obese spirit covered in trash that represents the pollution of the rivers. In Miyazaki's films, forests have personalities, trees have feelings, and robots befriend birds. Considered a national treasure by the Japanese government, Miyazaki is an artist capable of becoming completely absorbed in his art. He uses a cell phone from the late 1990s, and he makes his entire team draw by hand. He directs his films by rendering on paper even the tiniest detail, achieving flow by drawing, not by using a computer. Thanks to this obsession on the director's part, Studio Ghibli is one of the only studios in the world where almost the entire production process is carried out using traditional techniques. Those who have visited Studio Ghibli know that it is fairly typical on a given Sunday to see a solitary individual tucked away in a corner hard at work. A man in simple clothes who will greet them with an ohayo, hello, without looking up. Miyazaki is so passionate about his work that he spends many Sundays in the studio, enjoying the state of flow, putting his ikigai above all else. Visitors know that under no circumstances is one to bother Miyazaki, who is known for his quick temper, especially if he is interrupted while drawing. In 2013, Miyazaki announced he was going to retire. To commemorate his retirement, the television station NHK made a documentary showing him in his last days at work. He is drawing in nearly every scene of the film. In one scene, several of his colleagues are seen coming out of a meeting, and there he is, drawing in a corner, paying no attention to them. In another scene, he is shown walking to work on December 30th, a national holiday in Japan, and opening the doors of Studio Ghibli so he can spend the day there, drawing alone. Miyazaki can't stop drawing. The day after his retirement, instead of going on vacation or staying at home, he went to Studio Ghibli and sat down to draw. His colleagues put on their best poker faces, not knowing what to say. 1 year later, he announced he wouldn't make any more feature films, but that he would keep on drawing until the day he died. Can someone really retire if he is passionate about what he does? The recluses. It is not only the Japanese who have this capacity. There are artists and scientists all over the world with strong, clear ikigais. They do what they love until their dying day. The last thing Einstein wrote before closing his eyes forever was a formula that attempted to unite all the forces of the universe in a single theory. When he died, he was still doing what he loved. If he hadn't been a physicist, he said he would have been happy as a musician. When he wasn't focused on physics or mathematics, he enjoyed playing the violin. Reaching a state of flow while working on his formulas or playing music, his two ikigais, brought him endless pleasure. Many such artists might seem misanthropic or reclusive, but what they are really doing is protecting the time that brings them happiness, sometimes at the expense of other aspects of their lives. They are outliers who apply the principles of flow to their lives to an extreme. Another example of this kind of artist is the novelist Haruki Murakami. He sees only a close circle of friends and appears in public in Japan only once every few years. Artists know how important it is to protect their space, control their environment, and be free of distractions if they want to flow with their ikigai. Microflow. Enjoying mundane tasks. But what happens when we have to, say, do the laundry, mow the lawn, or attend to paperwork? Is there a way to make these mundane tasks enjoyable? Near the Shinjuku subway station, in one of the neural centers of Tokyo, there is a supermarket that still employs elevator operators. The elevators are fairly standard and could easily be operated by the customers, but the store prefers to provide the service of someone holding the door open for you, pushing the button for your floor, and bowing as you exit. If you ask around, you'll learn that there is one elevator operator who's been doing the same job since 2004. She is always smiling and enthusiastic about her work. How is she able to enjoy such a job? Doesn't she get bored doing something so repetitive? On closer inspection, it becomes clear that the elevator operator is not just pushing buttons, but is instead performing a whole sequence of movements. She begins by greeting the customers with a song-like salutation, followed by a bow and a welcoming wave of the hand. Then she presses the elevator button with a graceful movement, as though she is a geisha offering a client a cup of tea. Csikszentmihalyi calls this microflow. We've all been bored in a class or at a conference and started doodling to keep ourselves entertained, or whistled while painting a wall. If we're not truly being challenged, we get bored and add a layer of complexity to amuse ourselves. Our ability to turn routine tasks into moments of microflow, into something we enjoy, is key to our being happy, since we all have to do such tasks. Even Bill Gates washes the dishes every night. He says he enjoys it, that it helps him relax and clear his mind, and that he tries to do it a little better each day, following an established order or a set of rules he's made for himself. Plates first, forks second, and so on. It's one of his daily moments of microflow. Richard Feynman, one of the most important physicists of all time, also took pleasure in routine tasks. W. Daniel Hillis, one of the founders of the supercomputer manufacturer Thinking Machines, hired Feynman to work on a development of a computer that could handle parallel processing when he was already world famous. He says Feynman showed up on his first day of work and said, "Okay, boss, what's my assignment?" They didn't have anything prepared, so they asked him to work on a certain mathematical problem. He immediately realized they were giving him an irrelevant task to keep him busy and said, "That sounds like a bunch of baloney. Give me something real to do." So they sent him to a nearby shop to buy office supplies, and he completed his assignment with a smile on his face. When he didn't have something important to do or needed to rest his mind, Feynman dedicated himself to microflowing, say, painting the office walls. Weeks later, after visiting the Thinking Machines offices, a group of investors declared, "You have a Nobel laureate in their painting walls and soldering circuits." Instant vacations, getting there through meditation. Training the mind can get us to a place of flow more quickly. Meditation is one way to exercise our mental muscles. There are many types of meditation, but they all have the same objective: calming the mind, observing our thoughts and emotions, and centering our focus on a single object. The basic practice involves sitting with a straight back and focusing on your breath. Anyone can do it, and you feel a difference after just one session. By fixing your attention on the air moving in and out of your nose, you can slow the torrent of thoughts and clear your mental horizons. The Archer's Secret. The winner of the 1988 Olympic gold medal for archery was a 17-year-old woman from South Korea. When asked how she prepared, she replied that the most important part of her training was meditating for 2 hours each day. If we want to get better at reaching a state of flow, meditation is an excellent antidote to our smartphones and their notifications constantly clamoring for our attention. One of the most common mistakes among people starting to meditate is worrying about doing it right, achieving absolute mental silence, or reaching nirvana. The most important thing is to focus on the journey. Since the mind is a constant swirl of thoughts, ideas, and emotions, slowing down the centrifuge, even for just a few seconds, can help us feel more rested and leave us with a sense of clarity. In fact, one of the things we learned in the practice of meditation is not to worry about anything that flits across our mental screen. The idea of killing our boss might flash into our mind, but we simply label it as a thought and let it pass like a cloud without judging or rejecting it. It is only a thought, one of the 60,000 we have every day, according to some experts. Meditation generates alpha and theta brainwaves. For those experienced in meditation, these waves appear right away, while it might take half an hour for a beginner to experience them. These relaxing brainwaves are the ones that are activated right before we fall asleep, as we lie in the sun, or right after taking a hot bath. We all carry a spa with us everywhere we go. It's just a matter of knowing how to get in. Something anyone can do with a bit of practice. Humans as ritualistic beings. Life is inherently ritualistic. We could argue that humans naturally follow rituals that keep us busy. In some modern cultures, we have been forced out of our ritualistic lives to pursue goal after goal in order to be seen as successful. But throughout history, humans have always been busy. We were hunting, cooking, farming, exploring, and raising families, activities that were structured as rituals to keep us busy throughout our days. But in an unusual way, rituals still permeate daily life and business practices in modern Japan. The main religions in Japan, Confucianism, Buddhism, and Shintoism, are all ones in which the rituals are more important than absolute rules. When doing business in Japan, process, manners, and how you work on something is more important than the final results. Whether this is good or bad for the economy is beyond the scope of this book. What is indisputable, though, is that finding flow in a ritualistic workplace is much easier than in one in which we are continually stressed out trying to achieve unclear goals set by our bosses. Rituals give us clear rules and objectives, which help us enter a state of flow. When we have only a big goal in front of us, we might feel lost or overwhelmed by it. Rituals help us by giving us the process, the sub-steps, on the path to achieving a goal. When confronted with a big goal, try to break it down into parts and then attack each part one by one. Focus on enjoying your daily rituals, using them as tools to enter a state of flow. Don't worry about the outcome. It will come naturally. Happiness is in the doing, not in the result. As a rule of thumb, remind yourself, rituals over goals. The happiest people are not the ones who achieve the most. They are the ones who spend more time than others in a state of flow. Using flow to find your ikigai. After reading this chapter, you should have a better idea of which activities in your life make you enter flow. Write all of them down on a piece of paper, then ask yourself these questions. What do the activities that drive you to flow have in common? Why do those activities drive you to flow? For example, are all the activities you most like doing ones that you practice alone or with other people? Do you flow more when doing things that require you to move your body or just to think? In the answers to these questions, you might find the underlying ikigai that drives your life. If you don't, then keep searching by going deeper into what you like by spending more of your time in the activities that make you flow. Also, try new things that are not on the list of what makes you flow, but that are similar and that you are curious about. For example, if photography is something that drives you into flow, you could also try painting. You might even like it more. Or if you love snowboarding and have never tried surfing. Flow is mysterious. It is like a muscle. The more you train it, the more you will flow, and the closer you will be to your ikigai. 5. Masters of Longevity. Words of wisdom from the longest living people in the world. When we started working on this book, we didn't want to just research the factors that contribute to a long and happy life. We wanted to hear from the true masters of this art. The interviews we conducted in Okinawa merit their own chapter, but in the section that precedes it, we have provided an overview of the life philosophies of a few international champions of longevity. We're talking about supercentenarians, people who live to 110 years of age or more. The term was coined in 1970 by Norris McWhirter, editor of the Guinness Book of World Records. Its use became more widespread in the 1990s after it appeared in William Strauss and Neil Howe's Generations. Today, there are an estimated 300 to 450 supercentenarians in the world, although the age of only around 75 of them has been confirmed. They aren't superheroes, but we could see them as such for having spent far more time on this planet than the average life expectancy would predict. Given the rise in life expectancy around the world, the number of supercentenarians might also increase. A healthy and purposeful life could help us join their ranks. Let's take a look at what a few of them have to say. Misao Okawa, 117. Eat and sleep, and you'll live a long time. You have to learn to relax. According to the Gerontology Research Group, until April 2015, the oldest living person in the world was Misao Okawa, who passed away in a care facility in Osaka, Japan, after living for 117 years and 27 days. The daughter of a textile merchant, she was born in 1898, when Spain lost its colonies in Cuba and the Philippines, and the United States annexed Hawaii and launched Pepsi Cola. Until she was 110, this woman, who lived in three different centuries, cared for herself unassisted. When specialists asked about her self-care routine, Misao answered simply, "Eating sushi and sleeping," to which we should add, having a tremendous thirst for life. When they inquired about her secret for longevity, she answered it with a smile, "I ask myself the same thing." Proof that Japan continues to be a factory of long life, in July of the same year, Sakari Momoi passed away at 112 years and 150 days old. At the time, he was the oldest man in the world, though he was younger than 57 women. Maria Capovilla, 116. I've never eaten meat in my life. Born in Ecuador in 1889, Maria Capovilla was recognized by Guinness as the world's oldest person. She died of pneumonia in 2006 at 116 years and 347 days old, leaving behind three children, 12 grandchildren, and 20 great and great-great-grandchildren. She gave one of her last interviews at age 107, sharing her memories and her thoughts. "I'm happy, and I give thanks to God, who keeps me going. I never thought I'd live so long. I thought I'd die long ago. My husband, Antonio Capovilla, was the captain of a ship. He passed away at 84. We had two daughters and a son, and now I have many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Things were better back in the old days. People behaved better. We used to dance, but we were more restrained. There was this one song I loved dancing to, Maria by Luis Aragon. I still remember most of the words. I also remember many prayers and say them every day. I like the waltz and can still dance it. I also still make crafts. I still do some of the things I did when I was in school." When she had finished recalling her past, she began to dance, one of her great passions, with an energy that made her seem decades younger. When asked about her secret for longevity, she responded simply, "I don't know what the secret to long life is. The only thing I do is I've never eaten meat in my life. I attribute it to that." Jean Calment, 122. Everything's fine. Born in Arles, France, in February 1875, Jean Calment lived until August the 4th, 1997, making her, at 122, the oldest person of verified age in history. She jokingly said that she competed with Methuselah, and there is no question that she broke numerous records as she went on celebrating birthdays. She died of natural causes at the end of a happy life during which she denied herself almost nothing. She rode a bicycle until she turned 100. She lived on her own until 110, when she agreed to move into a nursing home after accidentally starting a small fire in her apartment. She stopped smoking at 120 when her cataracts started making it hard for her to bring a cigarette to her lips. One of her secrets may have been her sense of humor. As she said on her 120th birthday, "I see badly, I hear badly, and I feel bad, but everything's fine." Walter Brueding, 114. If you keep your mind and body busy, you'll be around a long time. Born in Minnesota in 1896, Walter Brueding was able to see 3 centuries in his lifetime. He died in Montana in 2011 from natural causes. He'd had 2 wives and a 50-year career on the railroad. At 83, he retired to an assisted living center in Montana, where he remained until his death. He is the 2nd oldest man of verified age ever born in the United States. He gave many interviews in his final years, insisting that his longevity stemmed from, among other things, his habit of eating only 2 meals per day and working for as many years as he could. "Your mind and your body, you keep both busy," he said on his 112th birthday. "You'll be here a long time." Back then, he was still exercising every day. Among Brueding's other secrets, he had a habit of helping others, and he wasn't afraid of dying. As he declared in a 2010 interview with the Associated Press, "We're all going to die. Some people are scared of dying. Never be afraid to die, because you're born to die." Before passing away in 2011, he is said to have told a pastor that he'd made a deal with God. If he wasn't going to get better, it was time to go. Alexander Image, 111. "I just haven't died yet." Born in Poland in 1903, Alexander Image was a chemist and a parapsychologist residing in the United States who, after the death of his predecessor in 2014, became the oldest man of authenticated age in the world. Image himself died shortly thereafter in June of that year, leaving behind a long life rich with experiences. Image attributed his longevity to, among other things, never drinking alcohol. "It's not as though I'd won the Nobel Prize," he said upon being declared the world's oldest man. "I never thought I'd get to be so old." When asked about his secret to living so long, his answer was, "I don't know. I just haven't died yet." Ikigai Artists. The secret to long life, however, is not held by supercentenarians alone. There are many people of advanced age who, though they haven't made it into the Guinness World Records, offer us inspiration and ideas for bringing energy and meaning to our lives. Artists, for example, who carry the torch for their ikigai instead of retiring, have this power. Art, in all its forms, is an ikigai that can bring happiness and purpose to our days. Enjoying or creating beauty is free, and something all human beings have access to. Hokusai, the Japanese artist who made woodblock prints in the ukiyo-e style and lived for 88 years, from the mid-18th to the mid-19th century, added this postscript to the first edition of his 100 Views of Mount Fuji. "All that I have produced before the age of 70 is not worth being counted. It is at the age of 73 that I have somewhat begun to understand the structure of true nature, of animals and grasses, and trees and birds, and fishes and insects. Consequently, at 80 years of age, I shall have made still more progress. At 90, I hope to have penetrated into the mystery of things. At 100 years of age, I should have reached decidedly a marvelous degree, and when I shall be 110, all that I do, every point and every line, shall be instinct with life." In the pages that follow, we've collected some of the most inspirational words from artists interviewed by Camille Sweeney for the New York Times. Of those still living, none have retired, and all still enjoy their passion, which they plan to pursue until their final breath, demonstrating that when you have a clear purpose, no one can stop you. The actor Christopher Plummer, still working at 86, reveals a dark desire shared by many who love the profession. We want to drop dead on stage. That would be a nice theatrical way to go. Osamu Tezuka, the father of modern Japanese manga, shared this feeling. Before he died in 1989, his last words as he drew one final cartoon were, "Please, just let me work." The 86-year-old filmmaker Frederick Wiseman declared on a stroll through Paris that he likes to work, which is why he does it with such intensity. "Everybody complains about their aches and pains and all that, but my friends are either dead or still working," he said. Carmen Herrera, a painter who just entered her 100th year, sold her first canvas at age 89. Today, her work is in the permanent collections of the Tate Modern and the Museum of Modern Art. When asked how she viewed the future, she responded, "I am always waiting to finish the next thing. Absurd, I know. I go day by day." Never stop learning. You may grow old and trembling in your anatomies. You may lie awake at night listening to the disorder of your veins. You may miss your only love. You may see the world about you devastated by evil lunatics, or know your honor trampled in the sewers of baser minds. There is only one thing for it, then, to learn. Learn why the word wags and what wags it. That is the only thing which the mind can never exhaust, never alienate, never be tortured by, never fear or distrust, and never dream of regretting. T.H. White, the once and future king. For his part, naturalist and author Edward O. Wilson asserted, "I feel I have enough experience to join those who are addressing big questions. About 10 years ago, when I began reading and thinking more broadly about the questions of what are we, where did we come from, and where are we going, I was astonished at how little this was being done." Ellsworth Kelly, an artist who passed away in 2015 at the age of 92, assured us that the idea that we lose our faculties with age is in part a myth, because instead we develop a greater clarity and capacity for observation. "It's one thing about getting older, you see more. Every day I'm continuing to see new things. That's why there are new paintings." At 86, the architect Frank Gehry reminds us that some buildings can take 7 years from the time you're hired until you're finished, a fact that favors a patient attitude with regard to the passage of time. The man responsible for the Guggenheim Museum Bilbao, however, knows how to live in the here and now. You stay in your time. You don't go backward. I think if you relate to the time you're in, you keep your eyes and ears open. Read the paper. See what's going on. Stay curious about everything. You will automatically be in your time. Longevity in Japan. Because of its robust civil registry, many of those verified as having lived the longest are found in the United States. However, there are many centenarians living in remote villages in other countries. A peaceful life in the countryside seems pretty common amongst people who have watched a century pass. Without question, the international superstar of longevity is Japan, which has the highest life expectancy of any country in the world. In addition to a healthy diet, which we will explore in detail, and an integrated healthcare system in which people go to the doctor for regular checkups to prevent disease, longevity in Japan is closely tied to its culture, as we will see later on. The sense of community and the fact that Japanese people make an effort to stay active until the very end are key elements of their secret to long life. If you want to stay busy even when there's no need to work, there has to be an ikigai on your horizon, a purpose that guides you throughout your life and pushes you to make things of beauty and utility for the community and yourself. 6. Lessons from Japan's centenarians. Traditions and proverbs for happiness and longevity. To get to Ogimi, we had to fly nearly 3 hours from Tokyo to Naha, the capital of Okinawa. Several months earlier, we had contacted the town council of a place known as the Village of Longevity to explain the purpose of our trip and our intention to interview the oldest members of the community. After numerous conversations, we finally got the help we were looking for and were able to rent a house just outside the town. 1 year after starting this project, we found ourselves on the doorstep of some of the longest living people in the world. We realized right away that time seemed to have stopped there, as though the entire town were living in an endless here and now. Arriving in Ōgimi. After 2 hours on the road from Naha, we're finally able to stop worrying about the traffic. To our left are the sea and an empty stretch of beach. To our right, the mountainous jungle of Okinawa's Yanbaru forests. Once Route 58 passes Nago, where Orion Beer, the pride of Okinawa, is made, it skirts the coast until it reaches Ōgimi. Every now and then, a few little houses and stores crop up in the narrow stretch of land between the road and the base of the mountain. We pass small clusters of houses scattered here and there as we enter the municipality of Ōgimi. But the town doesn't really seem to have a center. Our GPS finally guides us to our destination, the Center for the Support and Promotion of Well-Being, housed in an unattractive cinder block building right off the highway. We go in through the back door, where a man named Taira is waiting for us. Beside him is a petite, cheerful woman who introduces herself as Yuki. Two other women immediately get up from desks and show us to a conference room. They serve us each a cup of green tea and a few shikwasa, a small citrus fruit that packs a big nutritional punch, as we will see later on. Taira sits down across from us in his formal suit and opens up a large planner and a three-ring binder. Yuki sits next to him. The binder contains a list of all the town's residents organized by age and club, or moai. Taira points out that these groups of people who help one another are characteristic of Ōgimi. The moai are not organized around any concrete objective. They function more like a family. Taira also tells us that volunteer work, rather than money, drives much of what happens in Ōgimi. Everyone offers to pitch in, and the local government takes care of assigning tasks. This way, everyone can be useful and feels like a part of the community. Ōgimi is the penultimate town before Cape Hedo, the northernmost point of the largest island in the archipelago. From the top of one of Ōgimi's mountains, we're able to look down over the whole town. Almost everything is the green of the Yanbaru jungle, making us wonder where the nearly 3,200 residents are hiding. We can see a few houses, but they're scattered in little clusters near the sea or in small valleys accessible by side roads. Communal life. We're invited to eat in one of Ōgimi's few restaurants, but when we arrive, the only three tables are already reserved. Don't worry, we'll go to Churaumi instead. It never fills up, says Yuki, walking back to her car. She's still driving at age 88 and takes great pride in that. Her co-pilot is 99 and has also decided to spend the day with us. We have to drive fast to keep up with them on a highway that is sometimes more dirt than asphalt. Finally reaching the other end of the jungle, we can at last sit down to eat. I don't really go to restaurants, Yuki says as we take our seats. Almost everything I eat comes from my vegetable garden, and I buy my fish from Tanaka, who's been my friend forever. The restaurant is right by the sea and seems like something from the planet Tatooine from Star Wars. The menu boasts in large letters that it serves slow food prepared with organic vegetables grown in the town. But really, Yuki continues, food is the least important thing. She is extroverted and rather pretty. She likes to talk about her role as the director of several associations run by the local government. Food won't help you live longer, she says, bringing to her lips a bite of the diminutive confection that followed our meal. The secret is smiling and having a good time. There are no bars and only a few restaurants in Ōgimi, but those who live there enjoy a rich social life that revolves around community centers. The town is divided into 17 neighborhoods, and each one has a president and several people in charge of things like culture, festivals, social activities, and longevity. Residents pay close attention to this last category. We're invited to the community center of one of the 17 neighborhoods.